Hello and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for Tuesday, June 14th, 2022. And I am your reader, Peter Welch. Barr, Trump detached from reality. Former president's false 2020 election claims dismantled. In Washington, Donald Trump's closest campaign advisors, top government officials, and even his family were dismantling his false claims of 2020 election fraud ahead of January 6th. But the defeated president was becoming detached from reality and clinging to outlandish theories to stay in power, the committee investigating the Capitol attack was told on Monday. With gripping testimony, the panel is laying out in step-by-step fashion how Trump ignored his own campaign team's data as one state after another flipped to Joe Biden and instead latched on to conspiracy theories, court cases, and his own declarations of victory rather than having to admit defeat. Trump's big lie of election fraud escalated and transformed into marching orders that summoned supporters to Washington and then sent them to the Capitol on January 6th to block Biden's victory. He's become detached from reality. If he really believes this stuff, said former Attorney General William Barr, who called the voting fraud claims bogus and idiotic, and resigned in the aftermath, "I don't want to be a part of it." The House 1/6 committee spent the morning hearing delivering into Trump's false claims of election fraud and the countless ways those around him tried to convince the defeated Republican president they were not true and that he had simply lost the election. The witness Monday, mostly all Republicans and many testifying in pre-recorded videos, described in blunt terms and sometimes exasperated details how Trump refused to take the advice of those closest to him, including his family members, as the people around him splintered into a team normal headed by a former campaign manager, Bill Stephan, and others led by Trump, confident Rudy Giuliani, the president, chose his sides. On election night, Stephan said Trump was growing increasingly unhappy and refusing to accept the grim outlook. Son-in-law Jared Kushner tried to steer Trump away from Attorney Giuliani and his far-flung theories of voter fraud that advisors believed were not true. The president wouldn't have none of it. The back and forth intensified. In the run-up to January 6th, former Justice Department official Richard Donahue recalled breaking down one claim after another, from a truckload of ballots in Pennsylvania to a missing suitcase of ballots in Georgia, and telling Trump, "Much of the info you're getting is false." Still, Trump pressed on with his false claims even after dozens of court cases collapsed. The panel also provided new information about how Trump's fundraising machine collected some $250 million with his campaign to stop the steal and others in the aftermath of the November election, mostly from small dollar donations from Americans. One plea for each went out to 30 minutes before the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Not only was there the big lie, there was the big ripoff, said Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California. Chairman Republican Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, opened Monday's hearing saying Trump betrayed the trust of the American people and tried to remain in office when people had voted him out. As the hearings play out for the public, they are being watched by one of the most important viewers, Attorney General Merrick Garland, who must decide whether his department can and should prosecute Trump, No sitting or former president has ever faced such an indictment. I am watching, Garland said Monday at a press briefing at the Justice Department, even if he may not watch all of the hearings live. And I can assure you that the January 6th prosecutors are watching all of the hearings as well. Biden was getting updates, but not watching blow by blow. And White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. Stephen was to be a key in-person witness Monday, but abruptly backed out of appearing live because his wife went into labor. Stephen, who is still close to Trump, had been subpoenaed to appear. He's now a top campaign advisor to the Trump-endorsed House candidate, Harriet Hagerman, who is challenging committee Vice Chair Republican Liz Cheney in the Wyoming Republican primary. The panel marched ahead after a morning scramble and delay with witnesses after witness saying that Trump latched on to and repeated false claims about the election, although those closest told him that the theories of stolen ballots or rigged voting machines were simply not true. Stephen and senior advisor Jason Miller described how the festive mood of the White House on election night turned grim as the Fox News announced that Trump had lost the state of Arizona to Joe Biden, and aides worked to counsel Trump on what to do next. But he ignored their advice, choosing instead to listen to Giuliani, who was described as inebriated by several witnesses. Giuliani issued a general denial on Monday, rejecting all falsehoods. He said were being said about him. Stephen said that my recommendation was to say that votes were still being counted. It's too early to call the race. But Trump thought I was wrong. He told me so. Barr also testified in last week's blockbuster hearing and said that Trump was as mad as I've ever seen him. When the attorney general later explained that the Justice Department would not take sides in the election. For the past year, the committee has been investigating the most violent attack on the Capitol since the War of 1812, which some believe posed a grave threat to democracy. Monday's hearing also featured live witnesses, including Chris Steigerwalt, a former Fox News Channel political editor, who declared on election night that Arizona was being won by Biden. Also appearing was the former U.S. attorney in Atlanta, B.J. Pack, who abruptly resigned after Trump presumed Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find enough votes overturn his defeat. McNider makes waves at Arts Fest. Festivities were held in front lawn of the museum and the library. The McNider Art Museum made waves and made memories for many families on Saturday. The annual McNider Arts Festival aimed to encourage creativity with its theme, Create Waves. Festivities and an outdoor market were held on the front lawn of the museum and in front of the Mason City Public Library. It's a great way for kids, if maybe they haven't taken a class here, but they want to try something out, said Mara Linsky, Design Associate Curator and Registrar. The festival is a great getaway into the broader world of art. Linsky and Deegan said that she was happy with the turnout, considering that the overcast skies had some light rain showers. Even with the rain, we have quite a few people, and all the booths seem to be full of people. It's a great way to support local and regional artists, Linsky Deegan said. Children had the chance to create a variety of crafts to take home, try face painting, and play with the museum's imagination playground blocks. Little artists were running from craft to craft, experimenting with the supplies in front of them. Each was particular, was particular about the craft that they selected, carefully considering paint color and what glitter to use. Mason City resident Mara Lee Campbell enjoyed the festival with her family, watching the little ones have fun with watercolors. Campbell has been attending for around 5 years and has a little bit of an artist background herself. We really appreciate all the volunteers in the art museum and the culture it brings in, Campbell said. There was also a free pancake breakfast, a feature that returned in 2022. Proceeds from the other festival foods, such as hamburgers and walking tacos, go to benefit the festival and museum programming. Local artists featured their work in the outdoor market area. The art of being sold ranged from jewelry to detailed pencil drawings. Ceramics artist Bill Mater was one artist showcasing his work for people to buy. Mater has been working with ceramics for 50 years. And he said that the McNider Arts Festival is a great space for area artists to display their work while inspiring the next generation. I think when we're thinking about younger artists and students, when they see things that other people are doing, that have been doing it for a long time, they get ideas on where they can go with their art, says Mater. They get good ideas and spark a little creative juices in their mind. Keys to play in Charles City in July, 20th anniversary of the Court of Dreams celebration. Tennis enthusiasts throughout North Iowa will be meeting at the Court of Dreams in Charles City this July. International tennis star Madison Keys will be playing her way back to the Midwest to be part of the 20th anniversary named the Madison Keys Court of Dreams celebration of tennis. I grew up in Iowa, and I've always felt so inspired to try to come back to where I'm from and play tennis and bring tennis more into the community, said Keys of the event. The Court of Dreams is one of few pure grass tennis courts in the world. Keys said that it's truly one of the most special and unique courts in the world. Keys will be playing an exhibition match against a player to be named on July 15th at the Court of Dreams in Charles City. The event kicks off at 1 p.m. Anytime you can have somebody of Madison stature come into an area like Iowa, it's unbelievable the impact that has. The ability to inspire a generation of kids in an afternoon, this event really highlights that, and the ability to bring people together, said Ryan Narr, tournament director. Keys will be joined by additional tennis players, including New Zealand's KP Panu and Australia's Nathan Healy, for a junior clinic on July 14th at the Clear Lake Athletics and Wellness Center at 2 p.m. Pennsylvania and Iowa tennis's state champions are also expected at the event. The clinic will include a mental health panel at which the athletes present. Key spoke in a press conference about the importance of balancing her profession with her life outside the sport and with herself personally. Key's openness about the importance of mental health is apparent in her foundation, Kindness Wins. Key's foundation, Kindness Wins, is sponsoring this weekend in a conjunction with all Iowa lawn tennis clubs. Kindness Wins is an organization which funds and rewards acts of kindness on and off the court. It felt really important to me to do something positive with that, said Keys. Keys and her partners started the foundation during the pandemic to promote kindness and provide space for people to be open and honest about the hardship everyone was experiencing. It's likely that these topics will be included in the mental health panel, though details have not yet been released. Mark Kuhn, owner of operator of the Court of Dreams and the All Iowa Lawn Tennis Club, expressed his excitement for this event at the press conference and thanked Keys for being part of the celebration. In 1960, Kuhn and his grandfather found tennis by overhearing a Wimbledon broadcast on the radio. In 1962, Kuhn was doing chores and had a vision to build a grass court. Well, it took 40 years to do that. It took 50 years to get to Wimbledon, but it's been an amazing journey, and it's really a part of my family's legacy now, Kuhn said at the press conference. This two-day event series, created to promote positive self-esteem and mental health awareness, is a ticketed event. More information and ticket purchase can be found at https://courtofdreams.org/. And let's turn now to local and nation news. Grassley and Ernst take wait-and-see approach on gun legislation, but Grassley calls the bipartisan work encouraging. In Des Moines, Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, Iowa's Republican U.S. senators, are waiting to see the final version of bipartisan legislation containing modest gun controls proposals before stating whether they will support it. The legislation was the result of 2 weeks of negotiations between a bipartisan group of U.S. senators in response to recent mass shootings in the United States. But Grassley, who is up for re-election this fall, said he was encouraged to see the bipartisan group produce a proposal. The proposal would make juvenile records available during background checks whenever someone under the age of 21 buys a gun, ban convicted domestic abusers from being able to buy a gun, and send federal funding to states enacting so-called red flag laws, which attempts to temporarily take guns away from individuals who could be considered potentially violent. I'm encouraged to see the bipartisan group of senators making headway on the important issues of mental health, school safety, and curtailing gun violence, Grassley said in a statement emailed to the Gazette's Des Moines Bureau. As always, I need to see legislative text which has yet to be written before making a final decision on how I would vote, he says. I've said from the start that as we start to work toward improving safety, it's important that we safeguard rights enshrined in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. Ernst spokesperson Brendan Conley echoed Grassley's wait-and-see approach. While this is currently only an outline of general and unspecific proposals, Senator Ernst will evaluate the specifics of any legislation when there's a bill text to do so, Conley said in an email to the Des Moines Bureau. Ernst, in the past, has opposed similar language, calling the boyfriend loophole to banning domestic abusers from being able to buy a gun. Ernst, who has said that she was a victim of domestic violence, objected to a legislative proposal that would have retroactively classified assault convictions as felonies and barred those convicted from owning or buying guns. Simply disallowing people due process is not what we want to see, Ernst said in 2019. I think there are great ways to protect survivors in a way that don't strip away people's rights. The proposed legislation announced this past weekend does not reach as far on gun control as Democrats have called for, but many Democrats nonetheless praise the work done by the bipartisan group in an effort to achieve some action on gun regulations after decades of inaction amid dozens of mass shootings in schools, churches, and other public places. Will this bill do everything we need to end our nation's gun violence epidemic? No, but it's real, meaningful progress. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, a member of the bipartisan group that put together the gun violence, said it represents real, meaningful progress and breaks a 30-year logjam, demonstrating that Democrats and Republicans can work together in a way that truly saves lives. Will this do everything we need to end our nation's gun violence epidemic? No, but it's real. Meaningful progress, Murphy said in a social media post after the bipartisan deal was announced. There is not a timeline for when the legislation will be drafted and considered in the U.S. Senate. In his Monday response, Grassley also cited legislation he previously introduced, supporting its own bipartisan group of senators. The Eagles Act, he said, would expand the U.S. Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center to include a greater focus on school violence prevention. Nurse's license revoked for $5 million fraud scheme. He was indicted for conspiracy in 2020. The state of Iowa has revoked the license of a nurse convicted of conspiring to steal $5 million from the taxpayer-funded Medicare program. According to state records, Mark Hill, age 55, who currently lives in Laurel, Mississippi, was first licensed to practice nursing in Iowa in July of 2017. In September 2020, Hill was indicted in Montana for conspiracy to commit health care fraud. Prosecutors alleged that from October 2017 through April 2019, Hill provided telehealth consultations with patients for Integrated Support Plus Incorporated, a telemedicine company located in Florida. As a Montana licensed nurse practitioner, Hill allegedly collected bribes from various medical equipment suppliers in exchange for prescriptions orders for their products. Many of those prescriptions were not based on any sort of patient examination and sometimes involved no patient interaction at all. Hill and co-conspirator were accused of placing orders for 14,700 orthotic braces over 19 months, an average of 865 orders each month, or 29 orders per calendar day. Hill had personally signed about 7,097 of the brace orders, which led to $10 million in charges to the Medicare program, of which Medicare reimbursed $5 million and $54,866. Hill was allegedly paid close to $125,000 for the orders that he processed. In April 2021, Hill pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to commit health care fraud. 3 months later, he was sentenced to 9 months in prison in order to pay $5.1 million in restitution. 6 months after Hill entered his guilty plea in the case, the Iowa Board of Nursing charged him with a conspiracy to commit health care fraud. The board recently determined that the nature and seriousness of Hill's actions required the immediate revocation of his license in order to protect the public. The board's action has no practical effect since Hill's Iowa license expired in 2021. And in other news, in January 6, cases, one judge stands out. An Iowa couple climbed through a broken window of the U.S. Capitol and live-streamed a video of themselves inside. A Texas mortgage broker posed for a selfie in front of rioters breaching the building. An Indiana hair salon owner celebrated on Facebook a day after she joined the pro-Donald Trump mob. Federal prosecutors did not seek prison time for any of them after they pleaded guilty to petty offenses for their actions on the 6th of January in 2021. The judge had other ideas. U.S. Judge District Tanya Chutkin put them all behind bars, describing it as the appropriate punishment for their participation in the riot that halted the certification of President Joe Biden's victory, sent lawmakers running for their lives, and left dozens of police officers beaten and bloodied. As the number of people sentenced for crimes in the insurrection nears 200, An Associated Press analysis of sentencing data shows that some judges are divided over how to punish the rioters, particularly for the low-level misdemeanors arising from the attack. We're asking judges to do what they think is right, and they don't agree on what's right, said Greg Hunter, a lawyer defending several January 6 defendants. A House committee that held its first public hearing on Thursday cast a wide net in its investigation of the insurrection, examining how President Trump and his allies tried to undermine the election results. So far, the Justice Department's criminal investigation has focused primarily on the hundreds of Trump supporters who broke through public barricades, shattered windows, attacked officers, and stormed into the Capitol. Chutkan, a former assistant public defender who was nominated to the bench by President Barack Obama, has consistently taken the hardest lines against January 6 defendants of any judge serving on Washington Federal Trials Court, which is handling the more than 800 cases brought so far in the largest prosecution in Justice Department history. And let's turn now to other nation news. There is a photograph, and the caption highlighted says, "Hundreds in Western U.S. are forced to evacuate." There's a fire truck on a mountain with a large fire in the picture. The western U.S. on Monday marked another day of hot, dry, and windy weather as crews from California to New Mexico battled wildfires that had forced hundreds of people to leave their homes. Nationally, more than 6,200 wildland firefighters were battling nearly three dozen uncontained fires that had charred over 1 million acres, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. Above in this picture is a fire engine which is parked near the Sheep Fire Monday in Wrightwood, California. In other news, vulnerable Dems run against Washington. In New York, just like endangered Democrats in other states, Senator Catherine Cortez Masto is running against Washington. The Nevada Democrat, nearing the end of her first six-year term, ignores the fact that her party controls both chambers of Congress and the White House as she explains the rationale for her candidacy. "I'm running for re-election because you deserve a senator who will cut through the gridlock and dysfunction in Washington and deliver real results for your family," Cortez Masto says on her campaign website. "I'll work with anyone, Democrats, Republicans, independents, to help Nevada's families succeed." Cortez Masto, who will easily win her party's nomination for her term on Tuesday, is far from alone. Many of the nation's most vulnerable Democrats are actively trying to distance themselves from Washington and their party. Responding to deep frustration from voters who will decide their fate in November, Democratic candidates in swing states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Nevada, and New Hampshire are railing against the institutions that their party has managed for the past 16 months. It's a strategy born of necessity given the political climate Democrats are facing in 2022. President Joe Biden remains deeply unpopular, and an overwhelming majority of U.S. adults believe that the country is moving in the wrong direction. The Democrats who control Congress have failed to deliver on core campaign promises, and perhaps most concerning, the cost of basic goods like groceries and gasoline is soaring under their watch. The nationwide average price for a gallon of gasoline topped $5 for the first time ever over the weekend. Privately, Democrats concede that they're trying to strike a delicate balance. Some of the gridlock on Capitol Hill is the result of division in their own ranks. Two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona, have opposed key elements of Biden's agenda. at a Democratic fundraiser in California last week. Biden acknowledged as much, telling donors he needed two more senators to essentially overcome that resistance. You're listening to the reading of the Globe Gazette for June 14th, 2022. I'm your reader, Peter Welch. Now, let's take a look at the obituaries for today here on IRIS. Ted R. Enebent of Stillwater, Minnesota, has passed at the age of 94 in his home in Stillwater, Minnesota. Arrangements are being made with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory at 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue in Mason City. And you can contact them for more information at 641-423-0924 or go online at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Richard M. Hansen, age 79, has passed. Please visit goesfuneralcare.com for more details and to read his full obituary and share condolences with his family. Robert N. Frank of Mason City, age 82, has passed on Thursday, the 9th of June, at the Muse Norris Hospice Inpatient Unit. A memorial mass will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, June 17th, at Epiphany Parish St. Joseph Catholic Church, with the Reverend Neil Manternock officiating, and interment will follow in the Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 until 7 p.m. on Thursday, the 16th of June. Carmen Yvonne Didor of Mason City has passed at the age of 92 at the Heritage Care and Rehabilitation Center. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, the 17th of June, at the Bethlehem Lutheran Church at 419 North and Delaware in Mason City, with Pastor Sean Smith officiating. Interment will be held at 2 p.m. Friday at the St. John Lutheran Spring Foundation Cemetery at 1425 Usher Avenue in Summer, Iowa. And finally, a prolific actor, Hall, has passed at the age of 90 in New York. Philip Baker Hall, the prolific character actor of film and theater who starred in Paul Thomas Anderson's first movies and who memorably hunted down long overdue library book in Seinfeld, has died. His age was 90. Holly Wolf Hall, the actor's wife of nearly 40 years, on Monday said that Hall died Sunday, surrounded by loved ones in Glendale, California. She said that Hall had been well until a few weeks earlier and spent his final days in warm spirits reflecting on his life. His voice at the end was still just as powerful, said Wolf Hall. Her husband, she added, never retired from acting. Here's some of the credits of which Hall was known for. Among his many different works, there was The Insider as 60 Minutes producer Don Hewitt and Lars von Trier's Dogville. Hall appeared in Say Anything, The Truman Show, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Zodiac, Argo, and Rush Hour. Hall played the neighbor's Walt Klizek on Modern Family. His last performance was in the 2020 series Messiah. And now let's turn to some other news. In Digest, stock prices tumble on Wall Street. In New York, fears about a fragile economy forced Wall Street toward what's known as a bear market on Monday, with the S&P 500 tumbling 3.3%, more than 20% below its record set earlier this year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 741 points, or 2.4%, at 30,651 as of 3:05 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and the NASDAQ Composite was 4% lower. The center of Wall Street's focus was again on the Federal Reserve, which is scrambling to get inflation under control. Its main method is to raise interest rates in order to show the economy a blunt tool that risks a recession if used too aggressively. The sharpest drop hit what had been big winners of the earlier low-rate era. Tesla slumped 6.8%, and Amazon dropped 4.9%. GameStop tumbled at 8.3%. Police investigate killing in Ukraine. Police opened criminal investigations into the killing of more than 12,000 Ukrainians nationwide during Russia's war. And authorities in the Kyiv region near Bucha on Monday reported discovering the bodies of several victims whose hands were tied behind their backs. Shots to the knees tell us that people were tortured. The hands tied behind the back with tape say that the people had been held hostage for a long time, and enemy forces tried to get any information from them. Since the withdrawal of Russian troops from the region at the end of March, authorities say that they've uncovered the bodies of 1,316 people. One site reports on Monday was at a mass grave in a forest near Bucha, where the horrors of war shocked the world after a regional Russian withdrawal earlier in the war. Briefly, condo collapse. Attorneys who worked to secure settlements topping $1 billion in the collapse of a beachfront Florida condominium building in which 98 people died are requesting about $100 million in fees and costs. According to a court filing made public Monday, a judge will determine the final amount. Brexit. Britain's government on Monday proposed new legislation that would unilaterally change post-Brexit trade rules for Northern Ireland, despite opposition from some officials who say that the move violates international law. Capitol riot. In his first public testimony since the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot, Capitol Police official Eugene Goodman testified Monday that a man carrying a Confederate battle flag jabbed at him with the flagpole before joining the mob that chased him up a staircase. Kevin Seafried and his adult son Hunter are on trial on charges that they stormed the Capitol together. Trudeau. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has tested positive for COVID-19 for the second time, and just days after he met in person with U.S. President Joe Biden. The announcement came in a tweet on Monday. Cryptocurrency. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies collapsed Monday after a major cryptocurrency lender halted withdrawals from its platform, citing extreme market conditions. Lending platforms have come under scrutiny recently, and critics have called them effectively Ponzi schemes. And turning to other news in the nation, Ohio allows armed schools employees. In Columbus, Ohio, Ohio school districts could begin arming employees as soon as this fall, under a bill signed into law Monday by GOP Governor Mike DeWine. The law, as enacted, requires up to 24 hours of training before an employee can go armed and up to 8 hours of annual training. The training programs must be approved by the Ohio School Safety Center. And DeWine said he ordered the center to require the maximum 24 hours and the maximum 8 hours. Schools can provide additional training if they wish, DeWine said. Before announcing the bill signing, the governor outlined several other school safety measures he and other lawmakers have promoted, including $100 million for school security upgrades in schools and $5 million for upgrades at college. In other news, in South Korea, North is prepping nuke test. Washington, South Korea's top diplomat said on Monday that North Korea has completed preparations for a new nuclear test, that only a political decision by the country's top leadership can prevent it from going forward. After talks with Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Washington, South Korean Foreign Minister Park Jin said that North Iowa would pay a price if it goes ahead as feared with what would be its seventh nuclear test in the coming days. North Korea has completed preparations for another nuclear test, and I think only a political decision has to be made, Park said. Prior to Monday, U.S. and South Korean officials had said only that the North was nearing completion of such preparations. Apart from sanctions, Park did not say what price the North would pay or outline how the deterrence policy would change. But Blinken said that the United States and treaty allies, South Korea and Japan, could adjust their military postures in response. And briefly in the news, heat. The National Weather Service Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland, on Monday warned more than 100 million Americans to stay indoors if possible, as high temperatures and humidity settle in over the states, stretching through parts of the Gulf Coast, through the Great Lakes, and east to the Carolinas. And finally, in news briefs, Spacey, actor Kevin Spacey, has been formally charged with sexual offenses against three men in Britain and is expected to appear in a court in London this week. British police said that Monday that Spacey is due to appear at London's Westminster Magistrates Court on Thursday. And in other news, hundreds forced to leave homes, hot, dry conditions, winds complicate work for firefighters. In Flagstaff, Arizona, the western U.S. on Monday marked another day of hot, dry, and windy weather as crews from California to New Mexico battled wildfires that forced hundreds of people to leave their homes. Several hundred homes on the outskirts of Flagstaff, Arizona, were evacuated, and the Arizona Snowball Ski Resort was closed as a precaution because of a wildfire, the second to hit the area this year. Crews were expecting the gusts of up to 50 miles an hour as they battled the blaze and that has burned through parts of the footprint left by another springtime fire that destroyed more than two dozen homes. No homes have been lost in the fire that started Sunday and has burned about 8 square miles. It's literally like deja vu, said Coconino County Sheriff's spokesman John Paxton. We're in the same exact spot doing the same exact thing as we were a month and a half ago. People are tired. Wildfires broke out early this spring in multiple states in the western U.S., where climate change and an enduring drought are fanning the frequency and intensity of forest and grassland fires. The number of square miles burned so far this year is more than double the 10-year national average, and states like New Mexico already have set records with devastating blazes that have destroyed hundreds of homes while causing environmental damage that is expected to affect future water supplies. Nationally, more than 6,200 wildland firefighters are battling nearly three dozen uncontained fires that had charred over 1 million acres, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. Even in Alaska, forecasters have warned that many fires in the southwest corner of that state have experienced exceptional growth over the last week, which is unusual for that area. Southwest Alaska normally experiences shorter periods of high fire danger, since intermittent rain can provide relief. But since mid-May, that region has been hot and windy, helping to dry out vegetation. Favorable weather Monday helped slow progression of a tundra wildfire just over 3 miles away from an Alaska native village. Moderate temperatures and a shift in the wind that had been driving the fire towards St. Mary's will allow firefighters to directly attack the flames and increase safety protections for the Yupik community. Wall Street falls into the bear market. At center of sell-off was Fed's efforts to fight rising inflation. In New York, Wall Street tumbled into what's called a bear market Monday after fears about a fragile economy and rising interest rates sent S&P's 500 more than 20% below its record set earlier this year. The index sank 3.9%, and the first chance for investors to trade after getting the weekend to reflect on the stunning news that inflation is getting worse, not better. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was briefly down more than 1,000 points before finishing with a loss of 876. At the center of the sell-off again was the Federal Reserve, which is scrambling to get inflation under control. Its main method to do that is to raise interest rates in order to slow the economy, a blunt tool to slow the economy, which also can risk recession if it is used too aggressively. With the Fed seemingly pinned into having to get more aggressive, prices fell in a worldwide rout for everything from bonds to Bitcoin, from New York to New Zealand. The best thing people can do is not to panic and don't sell at the bottom, said Randy Frederick, Managing Director of Trading and Derivatives at the Schwab Center for Financial Research. And we're probably not at the bottom. Some economists are speculating that the Fed on Wednesday may raise its key rate by 0.75 percentage point, something the Fed has not done since 1994. Now, let's turn to a column with the Globe Gazette that is going to be more in-depth about the riot that took place in Washington, D.C. This is called Takeaways from 2nd January 6th Hearing. Panel: Trump made up his mind on fraud ahead of riot. The House panel investigating the January 6th 2021 insurrection systematically made the case in its second hearing Monday that several of Trump's advisors warned him against making false claims of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election that he lost. But the president would not listen. The nine-member panel is trying to make the case that Trump and those allies who helped him were deliberately lying as he pushed those election falsehoods in the weeks ahead of the violent insurrection. The rioters who broke into the Capitol that day and interrupted the certification of President Joe Biden's victory were echoing Trump's lies that he, not Biden, had rightfully won the election. Takeaways from Monday's hearing. First, there's Trump's mind was made up. In a series of video clips from the committee's closed-door interviews, several of Trump's advisors testified that they told him repeatedly he should not declare that there was widespread election fraud and that those claims were false. But Trump increasingly relied on wild theories that were pushed by Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, among others, according to the testimony. In one clip, Trump's campaign manager Bill Stephan told investigators that Giuliani was urging Trump to declare victory on election night despite warnings from Stephan and others that it was way too early to make a prediction like that. Stephan was scheduled to testify in person on Monday, but pulled out at the last minute because his wife was in labor, according to his attorney. The panel showed clips of his closed-door interview instead. Despite the aide's efforts, Trump went to the podium in the White House press room on election night and said that the early results were a fraud on the American public and that, frankly, we did win this election. The panel showed video from Trump's daughter, Ivanka Trump, her husband, Jared Kushner, and campaign aide Jason Miller. Ivanka Trump told the panel that it was clear the elections wouldn't be called on election night. And Kushner said he told Trump at one point that Giuliani's advice was not the approach I would take. Trump responded that he had confidence in Giuliani, Kushner said. Miller said that Trump told a room of advisors that anyone who didn't agree with Giuliani was weak. The committee has not released any of the full interviews with the Trump's advisors or other witnesses. Blunt talk from Barr. Former Attorney General William Barr told the committee in a closed-door interview that the president was increasingly becoming detached from reality after the election. The committee aired video from interviews with Barr, in which he detailed his conversation with Trump before and after his December 1st declaration to the Associated Press that there were no evidence of widespread fraud in the election. Barr gave Trump's detailed explanation for why some of his theories were false. I told him it was crazy stuff, and they were wasting their time, and it was doing a grave, grave disservice to the country, Barr told the panel. Barr went on to say that the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, assured him that Trump was becoming more realistic and that Kushner had told him, "We're working on it." Debunking fraud in the states. The committee heard in person testimony from former U.S. Attorney B.J. Pack, who resigned as Trump pressured Georgia officials to overturn Biden's win in the state, and Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt, the only Republican on the city's election board. Pack testified that Giuliani misrepresented uncounted ballots in Fulton County, Georgia, in the weeks following the 2020 election. The allegation made by Mr. Giuliani were false, Pack told the panel. Schmidt said that city officials investigated Trump's fantastical claims to the fullest extent, but the results did not yield any substantial voter fraud. A months-long campaign. Trump's claim of fraud started well before Election Day. The committee showed clips where Trump previewed the strategy and speeches throughout his 2020 campaign. In August of that year, he told an audience that fraud was the only way he would lose. Stephan told the committee that he and the House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy had met with Trump in the summer of 2020 and made a two-pronged case for why he should stop criticizing mail-in voting, which was widely used because of the pandemic. He and McCarthy told Trump that he was leaving a lot to chance and that there were GOP party workers on the ground who could help get mail-in votes for Trump. The Red Mirage. Chris Sturwalt, a former political editor for Fox News Channel, made the election night call that President Joe Biden had won Arizona, a moment that prompted anger and disappointment in Trump's inner sanctum at the White House, Miller said. Testifying in person at the hearing, Sturwalt explained that the network, along with others, had expected that there would be a so-called red mirage at the beginning of the evening, as an in-person Republican voters came in, and many of the mail-in votes that would be counted later on would lean on the Democratic side. He noted it happens every election. Trump had not only exploited that pattern to make false claims of fraud, but contributed to it in his campaign to call mail-in voting into question. The end result. To close the hearing, the committee aired video of Trump supporters in Washington airing the false claims of fraud on the 6th of January. They all appeared certain that the election was stolen. Two of them repeated Powell's false assertions about voting machines that changed the results, claims that Barr had debunked weeks earlier. I don't want to say what we're doing is right, but if the election is being stolen, what's it going to take? Asked one rioter. And that does it for the reading of the Globe Gazette for June 14th, 2022, here on IRIS. I am your reader, Peter Welch. Thank you for listening.